Better this than the Third World Plan, where government is changed more often than socks. But the monumental gravity of government causes bad programs and policies not only to endure, but to become enshrined. And the immovable object slash irresistible force conundrum of government makes it something, a high school physics quiz, a train wreck, a vastly overweight friend who begs to come on our kayak trip, that we want to avoid. The least little manifestation of government will suffice as an example. How much would you think it would cost the U.S. Mint to produce a penny? You're half right. To manufacture this little item of pocket clutter is about twice as expensive as its nominal value, and its nominal value is nominal indeed. A penny will not buy a penny postcard or a penny whistle or a piece of penny candy. It will not even, if you're managing the U.S. Mint, buy a penny. The problem is the cost of zinc, which is what a copper is actually made of. For the past 25 years, a penny weight of copper has been worth considerably more than a penny. And we wouldn't want our money to have any actual monetary value, would we? That would violate all of the economic thinking that has been done since John Maynard Keynes. Therefore, the United States began making pennies out of less expensive zinc, with a thin plating of copper for the sake of tradition and to keep Lincoln from looking like he'd been stamped out of a galvanized feed trough. But then a rising commodities market drove up zinc prices. Maybe China needs a lot of zinc for, oh, I don't know, stabilizing the lead paint on Barbie dolls so that our girls don't start beating their girls on math tests or something. I learned about the penny's cost overrun in one of those little 5 or 6 column inch filler items that are now the mainstay of the once mighty wire services. This particular squib ran a while ago in the Boston Globe, but I didn't come across it until recently. I buy the Globe only for the comics, the Sudoku, and to train the puppy. I was arranging the sheets of newsprint on the kitchen floor, being careful to keep the editorial pages face down. I don't want to give any encouragement to the Boston Terrier's natural inbred liberalism. Anyway, there was the penny article. I suppose, as a fiscal conservative, and, at least until the cocktail hour, a responsible citizen, I should have been indignant. But to tell the truth, I was hopping about with glee, something that, by the way, is not advisable in a kitchen's puppy training area. You see, there are times when even we staunchest of libertarians lose our faith, or our faithlessness. That is to say, we lose our faith in our loss of faith in government. We catch ourselves thinking things like, whoa, what about the subprime mortgage market? That subpart was one moldy hoagie. Maybe there should be more government regulatory oversight. Or, wait a minute, just because I've been to the emergency room for string trimmer injuries 6 times in the past 2 years is no reason for my health insurance to be canceled. Since when is stupidity a pre-existing condition? Libertarians are only human. When we're tired and stressed, we're occasionally vulnerable to the kind of easy self-gratification and delusional thinking that leads to government dependency. But then comes a story like the penny costing 2 pennies, and its instant cold turkey. In for a penny, in for $16 million of wasted tax dollars spent to put 8 billion pennies into circulation each year. Take care of the pennies and the pounds of flesh extracted by the IRS will take care of themselves. A penny for your thoughts, and I'm not just picking your brain, I'm offering a 100% return on investment. The good news is you have a lot more money than you thought you did. We all do. A quick survey of my home indicates that the average American household has something on the order of 1 million pennies stashed in coffee cans, cigar boxes, quart jars, kitchen junk drawers, children's piggy banks, under car seats, between couch cushions, plus the 2 pennies in my old loafers from junior high in a box in the attic. So it's new home theater-sized flat-screen TVs all round as soon as we get done building our backyard zinc smelters. The bad news is that government is not just inert, but corruptly inert. Various public interest groups with, excuse me, common sense, have been trying to get rid of the penny for years. The Treasury Department itself does not like wasting $16 million a year on pennies when there are still so many banks, investment firms, and insurance companies in need of huge executive bonuses. The penny is a coin slot jamming curse to the vending machine industry. It is a cash register pant load and change making pain to retailers, not to mention a barrier to rounding all prices up a nickel. And the artificial demand for zinc created by the penny is anathema to the companies that have to pay more for zinc as a result. Everyone from the makers of buckets to the purveyors of cream to spread on cute lifeguard noses is mad at the penny. But to no avail. According to the somewhat smelly and discolored Boston Globe, Jarden Zinc Products, the nation's only supplier of the zinc blanks from which pennies are struck, has managed to block legislation banishing the penny. It has done so mainly by paying the political consulting firm Baker & Daniels LLP $180,000 to lobby against such legislation. Then again, is this really bad news? It's not great that we, the public, are paying double for something that isn't worth a red cent, but it is rather wonderful that for a mere $180,000, you can get government to sit there like a lump. Consider how many times in history governments should have sat there like a lump. What if Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor, Austria-Hungary's commencement of the First World War, or Napoleonic France's invasion of Russia could have been prevented for $180,000? Ah, the miracle of democracy. Always letting us get our 2 cents in. Part 2. What is to be done? Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? Thomas Jefferson, First Inaugural Address. 1. The USS Thresher bailout and the washing machine for her birthday stimulus plan. Did the 2008-2009 bailout of banks and financial institutions work? Well, here we are, a bit recessed, but not suffering from a Great Depression. If John Steinbeck were alive and writing his Pulitzer Prize-winning proletarian novel, the Jodes would be fleeing the Rust Belt rather than the Dust Bowl, and they'd still be headed toward a chimerical paradise of economic plenty, though in this case, Washington. Instead of a flivver, they'd be packed into a Nissan Murano, down payment courtesy of cash for clunkers, and the grapes, in The Grapes of Wrath, would be Zinfandel. As for the stimulus plan, the results seem to be PG-13 at best. Opinions differ on how stimulated we are. Whatever Harry Reid is feeling, Miranda Cosgrove on podcast does nothing for me. Here, according to the Congressional Budget Office, are some of the spending programs authorized by the $787 billion American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. $9.3 billion to invest in rail transportation. Last train to Clarksville. $6 billion to clean up sites formerly used by the Defense Department. Find someplace to bury, don't ask, don't tell. $4.6 billion to provide additional money to the Army Corps of Engineers, a basement dehumidifier for the French Quarter. $4 billion to provide additional financing for state and local law enforcement, taser guns for school crossing guards. $4 billion to repair and modernize public housing units. Where would you like this crate of bioengineered cockroaches, Mrs. Gilhooey? $3.2 billion to provide tax break to General Motors. We broke Oldsmobile, we broke Pontiac. $2.8 billion to provide additional money to the Department of Homeland Security. Secretary Napolitano, we just received this fax from Nigeria, from highly placed Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab. We could make a fortune. $2.5 billion to provide additional financing to improve communications in rural areas.
I'm away down here in the holler, Clam. Ain't heard a word you're saying. Why don't you use that there new megaphone you got from a government man?
$2 billion to provide additional child care. Give an extra sawbuck to the babysitter and let her buy her own six-pack. $2 billion to support battery manufacture. Every toy imported from China will be required by law to be batteries not included. $2 billion to finance renovations and technology upgrade at community health centers. New rectal thermometers for all. $1.3 billion to invest in air transportation. The bad news, they're charging you $50 for each piece of carry-on baggage. The good news, you get to lie down in the overhead bin. $1.2 billion to construct and repair veterans' hospitals and cemeteries. Found a place to bury, don't ask, don't tell. $1 billion to provide water to rural areas and western areas impacted by drought. Here's a bottle of Pellegrino for you, and a bottle of Pellegrino for you, and $1 billion to provide money for 2010 census. Counted 11 more Martha Coakley voters hiding in the big dig. $830 million to provide additional financing for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Sun's out, surf's up. $650 million to provide coupon to convert to digital television.
Hey, Lulu May, come on up out of the holler. Hee-haw reruns is on TV land.
$555 million to help defense employees sell homes. Paint walls a neutral color, keep lawn trimmed, flowers in a jar on the kitchen counter add a homey touch for prospective buyers. $510 million to repair and modernize 4,200 Native American housing units. Hold on 17, double down on face cards and tens. $500 million to help states and local school districts track student data and improve teacher quality. Everybody's grades have been posted on Facebook. Bow and muzzleloader season on teachers opens November 1st. $500 million to help states find jobs for unemployed workers. Get your brother-in-law a job making lists of strange things the federal government is spending stimulus money on in your state. $400 million to provide grants to states for energy-efficient vehicles and infrastructure. Mr. Mayor, here's your bike. $300 million to provide incentives for hiring disadvantaged workers, unless their disadvantage is that they're here illegally from Guatemala and are willing to work doing anything. $300 million to replace older vehicles owned by the federal government with hybrid and electric cars. Mr. President, it's Segway 1. $231 million to expand national service program. My name is Ben Bernanke. I'll be your server tonight. The specials are incredibly expensive. $192 million to equalize mass transit and parking benefits. New York City will park its subway cars in your carport, but you can park your SUV on the subway tracks. $70 million to help states provide services to homeless children. Kids, if you'd care to be seated on this piece of cardboard on the sidewalk, Ben will take your drink orders. And so on with 94 other interesting ways to spend your tax dollars. Assuming the American economy needed a stimulus, there was an alternate way to provide it. For only a couple of $100 billion more than the cost of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and who's even counting anymore, all federal personal income taxes could have been eliminated for a year. Personal income tax receipts were estimated at $953 billion in 2009. Footnote. Note ugly drop in personal income tax receipts since 2008. End note. This was the suggestion of my ex-congressman in the 2nd District of New Hampshire, Charlie Bass. With his display of common sense, you can see why Charlie is my ex-congressman. A year-long tax holiday would be quite the stimulus around my house. Muffin, age 12, could get a webcam to put on her own iCarly-type show, except with more giggling. Poppet, age 10, has been begging for a herd of miniature Nubian goats and a chance for a slot on the national goat rodeo circuit. We would be able to pay for her fancy, spangled goat roping outfits, no problem. Buster, age 6, wants a child-size Enola Gay with a Nerf A-bomb. My wife would like to drive her Kia Rondo over a cliff. And I have my eye on a new muzzle loader so I can bag Mr. Mansburden, my high school civics teacher, if he's still alive. The advantage of a tax abatement over a stimulus plan is that instead of idiots in Washington spending your and my money, us idiots get to spend our own. Our spending will be foolish, but not as foolish as government spending for the simple reason of committee brain. Individuals aren't as stupid as a group. It's the difference between Harvard and the Harvard football team, which any 11 kids from the Pop Warner League back where I come from in Ohio could whip by a dozen TDs without resort to the forward pass. Speaking of stupid people from Harvard, and that would be you, Larry Summers, how about the federal bailout? We'll take it as a given that the bailout was effective. That is, a bankruptcy judge wasn't sitting on the ATM when I went to use it at lunch hour. But it's hard to imagine that we taxpayers pulled all those singed, stinking bank and financial institution chestnuts out of the fire without causing a moral hazard. Moral hazard is the term economists use for a situation that reduces the incentive to avoid bad economic behavior. If you have an insurance policy for $1 million on a house that's worth $150,000, and you're behind on your mortgage payments anyway, you'll be less careful when lighting your gas grill. In fact, you may drag your gas grill into the middle of the living room and light it there, adding some gasoline in case it doesn't catch. The message that the U.S. government sent to the broke banks and beggared financial institutions was, "Don't you ever do this again, or we'll give you more money." After which there was a flurry of government regulatory activity to make sure it was illegal to do this again. And the banks and financial institutions won't do this again. They'll do that. John H. Cochran, professor of finance at the University of Chicago, wrote a thoroughgoing article, Lessons from the Financial Crisis, in the winter 2009-10 issue of the Cato Institute's Regulation magazine. Professor Cochran pointed out that the regulatory system ends up encouraging artificial obscurity. Make the rules tougher and they'll play the game tougher. Are the people named masters of regulation likely to be quicker and better motivated than the people named masters of the universe? Besides, as Professor Cochran noted, it was the regulated, supervised part of the market that failed. I've known Chris Cox for more than 20 years. Chris was head of the Securities and Exchange Commission when the financial crisis began. He was a congressman before his appointment. The average IQ in the House of Representatives dropped 50 points when he left, and what little moral capital there was in Congress sank to almost nothing. Still, the bastards outwitted him. There are 10 million people in the world trying to be the Solomon Brothers, and nobody's trying to be Chris Cox. Financial regulations are law, but finance is mathematics, and Chris Cox is brilliant, but he's a brilliant lawyer. What tipped the whistleblowers on the Bernie Madoff scheme was not whether all of Madoff's regulatory filings had been duly signed and witnessed, but the fact that Madoff's return on investment was too steady. Not too high, too steady. The thing that troubled people who are mathematically inclined, notably Boston investment analyst Harry Markopoulos, was how no formula of investment, no algorithm of trades, could be created to reproduce Madoff's returns. With the benefit of hindsight, you could make trades that were more profitable than Madoff's, and lots of people made trades that were less profitable than Madoff's, but nobody could flatline the high yields like Bernie. The trustees of Brandeis University didn't see the problem. The rest of us wouldn't have known what the rub was if it was down our shorts. As for the works of our current regulators, Professor Cochran said, "A lot of policy seems aimed at stopping anyone from ever again losing money in financial dealings." Try that at the Indian casino blackjack table. If you voted for Obama often enough, it might work. Said the good professor, "To give government officials the power to bail out firms at their discretion, especially if those officials are elected or political appointees, is practically to guarantee a bailout." Kill the spending, fuck the regulations, marry an investment banker. 2. And while we're at it... "Hello, bailout people, Mr. Secretary of the Treasury. Aren't you forgetting somebody? Like me? I'm a print journalist. Talk about financial crisis. Print journalists may soon have to send their kids to public schools, feed dry food to their cats, and give up their leases on Honda Insights and get the Hummers that are being offered at such deep discounts these days. The print journalism industry is taking a beating, circling the drain, running on fumes, especially running on fumes. You could smell Frank Rich all the way to Wasilla when Sarah Palin was nominated. Not that print journalism actually emits much in the way of greenhouse gases. We have an itty-bitty carbon footprint. We're Earth-friendly. The current press run of an average U.S. big-city daily newspaper can be made from one tree. Compare that to the global warming hot air produced by talk radio, cable TV, and Arianna Huffington. There are many compelling reasons to save America's print journalism, and I'll think of some while the bartender brings me another drink. In the first place, one out of three American households is dependent on print journalism. Footnote, for puppy training. End note. And if you think home foreclosures are disruptive to American society, imagine what would happen if USA Today stopped publishing. Lose your home and you become homeless, a member of an important interest group with many respected advocates and a powerful political lobbying arm. But lose your newspaper, and what are you going to do for covers on a cold night when you're sleeping on a park bench? Try blanketing yourself with Matt Drudge to keep warm. The government is bailing out Wall Street for being evil and the car companies for being stupid. But print journalism brings you Paul Krugman and Anna Quindlen. Also, in 1898, Joseph Pulitzer of the New York World and William Randolph Hearst of the New York Morning Journal started the Spanish-American War. All the Lehman Brothers put together couldn't cause as much evil stupidity as that. Moreover, rescuing print journalism is a twofer. Not only will America's principal source of Sudoku and Doonesbury be preserved, but so will an endangered species— the hard-bitten, cynical, heavy-drinking newshound with a press card in his hatband, a cigarette stub dangling from his lip, and free ringside prize-fight tickets tucked into his vest pocket. These guys don't reproduce in captivity, and there are hardly any of them left in the wild. I checked the bar. Just Mike Barnacle, as usual. How's tricks, Mike? Where'd everybody go? Sun's over the yardarm. Time to pour lunch. We print journalists are victims of economic forces beyond our control. We were as surprised as everyone else was by the sudden collapse of the reliable reporting market. We had no idea that real news and clear-eyed analysis were being bundled with subprime celebrity gossip, U.S. Weekly derivatives, and Jennifer Aniston/Sarah Jessica Parker swaps. We need a swift infusion of federal aid. Otherwise, all the information in America will be about Lindsay Lohan's sex life. Saving print journalism will be a bargain for the U.S. government. Nothing approaching $787 billion is required in our case. We'll settle for having the Treasury Department pay our tab at the Washington Palm. True, there is the danger that network television, with its much higher potential losses, will demand equal treatment, but this cannot be justified. Network television has been attempting to lure viewers for years with its low-interest programming, only to have those viewers discover that their brains are bankrupt. Some taxpayers may object to a print journalism bailout on the grounds that it mostly benefits the liberal elite. And we can't blame taxpayers for being reluctant to subsidize the repertorial careers of J-school twerps who should have joined the Peace Corps and gone to Africa to speak truth to power to Robert Mugabe. Senators and congressmen may have their objections as well. They want first call on those twerps themselves. Twerps make excellent Hill staffers and can help elected officials angle for appointment to high positions in the administration, such as boxer shorts bomb czar. Obviously, more twerps will be available if print journalism doesn't exist anymore. But I think we can ask America's legislators to make this sacrifice. Memo to polls from an old press hack. Strictly on the QT, the J-school twerps don't smoke, don't drink, do yoga, and will tell dailycost.com if you paw them. And I think we can ask taxpayers whether they would prefer to pay journalists to harmlessly tickle keyboards at the New Republic, or whether they would prefer to pay journalists to be in positions of influence on political policies that will wreck the taxpayers' lives. Remember, America, you can't wrap a fish in satellite radio or line the bottom of your birdcage with MSNBC, however appropriate that would be. It's expensive to swat flies with a BlackBerry. Newsboys tossing flat-screen monitors onto your porch will damage the wicker furniture. And a dog that's trained to piddle on your wireless router can cause a dangerous electrical short circuit and burn down your house. 3. Generation Vex. The financial crisis did not begin in September 2008. It began on October 15, 2007, and was reported the next day by the Associated Press. The nation's first baby boomer applied for Social Security Monday, the start of an avalanche of applications from the post-World War II generation. Kathleen Casey Kirschling, a former teacher from New Jersey, applied for benefits over the Internet. Casey Kirschling was born 1 second after midnight on January 1, 1946, making her the first baby boomer, a generation of nearly 80 million born from 1946 to 1964. O rend thy garments, America, heap ashes upon thy head. We, the generation of generations, triumphant in our multitudes, invincible, indomitable, insufferable, have come into our inheritance. Hereby we claim our birthright. Give us all your money. The pittance that is a current Social Security payment was intended to maintain the decrepit retirees of yore in their accustomed condition of thin gruel and single-car garages. Such chump change will hardly suffice for today's vigorous sexagenarians intent on, among other things, vigorous sex in places like Paris, St. Bart's, and Phuket. How can current Social Security allotments be expected to fund our skydiving, bungee jumping, hang gliding, and whitewater rafting, our skiing, golf, and scuba excursions, our photo safaris to Africa, bike tours of Tuscany, and sojourns at Indian ashrams, our tennis clinics, spa treatments, gym memberships, personal fitness training, and cosmetic surgery, our luxury cruises to the Galapagos and Antarctica, the vacation homes in Hilton Head and Vail, the lap pools, jacuzzis, and clay courts being built thereat, and the his-and-hers Harley-Davidsons. And we haven't even touched on the subject of Social Security's civil union life partner, Medicare. It won't take much skydiving, bungee jumping, hang gliding, and whitewater rafting before we all require new hips, knees, and elbows, fused spinal discs, pacemakers, and steel plates in our heads. The expense of these will be as nothing compared to the cost of our pharmacological needs. Remember, we are the generation that knows drugs. We know drugs, and we like drugs. From about 1967 until John Belushi died, we created a way of life based almost entirely on drugs. And we can do it again. Except this time, instead of us trying to figure out how to pay for it all by selling each other nickel bags of pot, you, the taxpayer, will be footing the bill. And did I mention that we'll expect to be airlifted to the Mayo Clinic every time we have an ache or pain? Nothing smaller than a Gulfstream G3, please. So just give us all the money in the federal, state, and local budgets. Forget spending on the military, education, or infrastructure. What with Afghanistan, falling SAT scores, and the California freeway system buried in mudslides, it's not as if the military, education, and infrastructure are doing very well anyway. Besides, you don't have a choice. We are 80 million strong. That's a number equal to almost two-thirds of the registered voters in the United States. Do what we say, or we will ballot you into a condition that will make Haiti look like Ibiza, where we'll be staying. And that's the good news. Emptying government coffers is the least of the damage that we baby boomers intend to inflict over the next 30 or 40 years. What we're really up to is something more diabolical. Our generation is going to do what our generation has always done best. We're going to shape the American social fabric to our will and make the entire nation conform to our ideals, judgments, and tastes. It will be like the Clinton administration, but much, much worse. An interesting irony, since in 08 you narrowly avoided getting a Clinton administration that was much, much worse. What we're going to do is make all of you old like we are. Old and dumpy and querulous and fuddled. We're achieving it already. Look at the hip young men walking around in their high-water pants, wearing stupid bowling shirts buttoned up to the collar. A bunch of 26-year-olds are going to coffee shops. Coffee shops, how antique, dressed as their grandpas. And what about teenage droopy drawers? That's Gramps' other fashion-forward look. Perfect for a weekend of crabgrass killing and mulching the hydrangeas. those great big cushy ugly sneakers, be they ever so expensive or young athlete endorsed, are nothing but the dread, comfortable shoes that have been worn forever by the geriatric. We have made mere school children as dependent upon Ritalin as we are upon Lipitor and Cialis. And notice that traffic jams are everywhere, but it's not because of too many cars or too few highway lanes. It's just slow driving in the famous old-age mode, with cell phones and onboard navigation systems to provide someone with whom to have a confusing, grumpy argument, even when you're alone. What else do oldsters do besides drive slowly? They watch TV. Leave it to the baby boom to invent something that makes viewing a small screen even worse than TV. The Internet. TV that talks back. Not that we haven't done a pretty good job of worsening TV as well. Flip through the cable channels and compare what you see to what was seen a generation ago. Jersey Shore versus The Dinah Shore Show. The Bachelor versus The Honeymooners. The Tonight Show versus The Tonight Show. When it comes to befuddled, is not the whole entertainment industry drooling in its second childhood? We baby boomers are growing old, but growing old with a vengeance. Our hands may be palsied and arthritic, but we hold America's fate in them. And America's fate can be summed up in one word. Youthanasia. 4. Healthcare reform. America's politicians are making enough noise about healthcare costs to wake the dead, an item on the Obama second-term legislative agenda. Medical care in America is expensive. Our country spent $2.5 trillion on healthcare in 2009, 17.6% of the gross national product, an amount equal to $8,170 per person. We persons, on the other hand, aren't spending anywhere near that much of our take-home pay on health care. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, consumer spending in 2007, the most recent figures available, the average annual household out-of-pocket expenditure on health care was $2,853. This is a third of what we spent on transportation and 10% less than what we spent on the transportation subcategory of vehicle purchases. Go for a drive or stay alive. What we spent on healthcare was just $185 more than what we spent on food away from home, which, given our obesity statistics, we shouldn't be eating. If we cut down on entertainment, $2,698, and did something more worthwhile, reading, $118, we'll have plenty to spend on the higher taxes that are on their way to fund less expensive healthcare. What part of the cost of medical treatment is supposed to get reformed? The cost or our cost? Somehow, in the mouths of politicians, it's always both. The quality of healthcare will increase, the quantity of healthcare will increase, the number of people receiving healthcare will grow, and therefore, healthcare will cost less. It was not my proudest moment as a Republican when, in a September 2009 joint session of Congress, Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina shouted, "You lie!" at the President of the United States during the President's speech about health care reform. Joe was definitely rude. Joe was probably in violation of parliamentary rules of order, and there's the possibility that Joe was not completely sober. But was Joe wrong? Something doesn't add up. Politicians are telling me that I can smoke, drink, gain 200 pounds, then win an Ironman triathlon at age 95. And will the reformers please quit talking about health care providers? What the hell is a health care provider? That could be some guy just off the boat from China with a fistful of rusty acupuncture needles. A health care provider was the school nurse when I was in third grade who gave you peppermint oil if you broke your neck on the playground. I caught Buster, my 6-year-old, playing healthcare provider with one of the little girls in his first grade class. They were filling out toy forms fully clothed. Why does medical treatment in America cost so much? It's not because doctors are getting richer. In 2009, the Archives of Internal Medicine published a study showing that between 1995 and 2003, the average annual income of primary care physicians dropped by 10.2% to $146,405, a lot less than we pay Joe Biden. One problem leading to high health care costs is the liability lawyer, of course, with his face up on billboards everywhere. You might have been maltreated on by a doctor and not even know it. But I don't want to make anyone ill by bringing up the subject of John Edwards. A worse problem is that we're getting what we pay for. Sally Pipes, no relation to the previously cited Richard Pipes, is the president of the Pacific Research Institute think tank in San Francisco. She is the author of two books and numerous articles about healthcare, and has been named by Forbes as one of the world's 30 leading experts on the subject. In The Top 10 Myths of American Healthcare, Pipes notes that for a man born in the United States in 1900, there was an almost 1 in 5 chance of dying before his first birthday. Now a man has to live to be my age before the annual mortality rate is 1 in 5, which is why I'm careful with things like stairs and go down to the wine cellar only 4 times on any given evening. We are, Pipes says, paying 14 times as much for medical treatment as we were in 1950. But since then, our life expectancy has increased by 10 years. It's not a spectacular bargain. Life expectancy in 1950 was 68, and by my calculation, for 14 times as much money, we should be living to age 952. But Medicare is already overburdened. And imagine getting trapped on a carnival cruise with some old fart who can't stop complaining about how nobody cooks pig bladder the way they did in 1066. 10 years isn't bad. I may live to see a Massachusetts Republican elected to the Senate. All that money hasn't done much to cure Alzheimer's. On the other hand, says Pipes, between 1950 and 2000, the death rate for heart disease, America's number one cause of mortality, not counting forgetting your wedding anniversary, which I blame on Alzheimer's, was reduced by 59%. And America's rate of infant mortality has gone from 29 per 1,000 live births in 1950 to fewer than 7. Yes, yes, but other countries have done better while spending less, say healthcare reformers. There are almost 30 other countries where life expectancy is longer than it is in the United States. Other countries are not the United States, Pipes points out. America's homicide rate was 5.9 per 100,000 people in 2004. Canada's was 1.95. Germany's was 0.98. America had 14.25 traffic fatalities per 100,000 people in 2006. Canada had 9.25. And France had 7.4. Because the French sit around in cafes all day and don't go anywhere except in August when French traffic is too jammed to kill anyone in. Maybe life just seems longer in other countries. Although you may live to a greater age overseas, don't get cancer while you're doing it. Pipes gives the following figures. The survival rate, 5 years after diagnosis of breast cancer, is 83.9% in the United States and 69.7% in Britain. Americans are 35% more likely to survive colon cancer than the British, and the prostate cancer survival rate is 91.9% in the United States, 73.7% in France, and 51.1% in the UK. About a dozen countries have a live birth mortality rate lower than America's, but don't fly there to be born if you're not feeling well. America has sophisticated neonatal facilities that help preemies survive. This doesn't make America look better statistically. Those premature babies are still at high risk, and if they die, they get counted as having died instead of being stillborn. The United States adheres to the World Health Organization's definition of live birth, wherein the baby breathes or shows any other evidence of life, such as beating of the heart, pulsation of the umbilical cord, or definite movement of voluntary muscles. In Switzerland, says Pipes, an infant must be at least 30 centimeters long at birth to be counted as living. In France, a live birth is not counted as such unless there is a medical certificate stating that the child was born alive and, here's the catch, viable. In France and Belgium, babies born at less than 26 weeks are automatically registered as dead. America's healthcare spending may be excessive, but one of the things we've bought with that excess is progress. The Cato Institute published a paper by Glenn Whitman and Raymond Rodd, an economist and a physician, respectively, about America's role in making everybody, even foreigners, healthier. Among the figures cited were the number of Nobel Prizes for medicine and physiology, more rigorously vetted, I understand, than Nobel Prizes for peace. Between 1969 and 2008, Americans were awarded 57 Nobels, 17 more than were received by residents of the EU, Switzerland, Japan, Canada, and Australia combined. The U.S. National Institutes of Health has an annual budget of over $30 billion. Its counterparts in Europe receive a total of between $3 billion and $4 billion. Whitman and Rodd also drew up a list of 27 most important innovations in medical diagnostics and therapeutics since 1975, drawing on 2001 research published in Health Affairs and updated with a survey of 225 primary care doctors. American scientists and physicians had a significant role in 20 of the inventions or advancements of technique, including 9 of the top-rated 10. Scientists and physicians from the EU and Switzerland made important contributions to 14 innovations and only 5 of the top 10, despite Western Europe being as wealthy as the United States and having almost 200 million more people. The Netherlands leads the way in treating bong injuries. Healthcare in America is expensive not only because we're brilliant and hardworking, we're also old and fat. Sally Pipes reminds us that 2/3 of Americans are overweight, 1/3 of us are obese, 1 out of 8 of us is over 65, and by 2030, when the baby boom is fully installed in Nike brand walkers, slogan, just do it, in Depends, the number will be 1 out of 5. An August 20, 2009 New York Times website article about dying hospital patients stated, with a hint of healthy young outrage that I'm not sure the New York Times is entitled to, that 1/3 of Medicare spending goes to patients with chronic illness in their last 2 years of life. Of course it does. That's when they're sick. And until we get sick, we're packing on the pounds. According to the Centers for Disease Control, weight-related medical bills accounted for $147 billion in healthcare spending in 2008. $147 billion is about half of what Medicare costs per year. My suggestion for healthcare reform is that we skip lunch and quit picking on sick people. This was not President Obama's suggestion. President Obama suggested we find somebody to pick on that we hate even more than we hate sick people. With the clear-sighted political instincts for which the president is known, he suggested we pick on health insurance companies. Everyone hates health insurance companies. Health insurance companies are always trying to get us to bet that something terrible will happen to us. And it's not like they're very good about paying up when they lose. Your heart? Pre-existing condition. You were born with a heart. The president's idea was that the government get into the health insurance business to compete with private sector health insurance companies. The government would be just another competitor, like any other health insurance company. The only difference is that this competitor, being the government, has the legal monopoly on deadly force. This competitor has guns. What's another competitor just like any other competitor except it has guns? Suddenly, over at Blue Cross, it was like being the last legit trash hauler in New Jersey. To put it another way, private sector health insurance companies are on the ducking stool. And President Obama has a scummy pool of numbers to dip them in. 46 million Americans, including nearly 8 million children, have no health insurance, figures that appeared in 2008 on the official Barack Obama website. That's 15% of the population. But if you enjoy hating health insurance companies, this is not a statistic you should look at too carefully, the way Sally Pipes did in Top 10 Myths. Myth 3, 46 million Americans can't get health care. It seems that almost 10 million of the uninsured make more than $75,000 a year, and 18 million make more than $50,000. These people should be able to buy some kind of health insurance or pay for their own medical treatment unless something extra terrible happens to them, the more so since these 28 million Americans tend to be young. 19 to 29-year-olds are one of the largest and fastest-growing segments of the uninsured population. Another 10 million uninsured Americans turn out not to be Americans. That is, they aren't U.S. citizens. Personally, I think when they get sick, they should get as well as anyone else. But, technically, they're uninsured Canadians, or uninsured Brazilians, or uninsured chain-smoking Czech grad school habitués overstaying their student visas, or whatever. Furthermore, as many as 14 million uninsured Americans aren't uninsured. They qualify for the social insurance available under Medicare, Medicaid, and/or State Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP, but they have not been enrolled. Among these are a full 70% of uninsured children. Let's see. 10 million plus 18 million plus 10 million plus 14 million equals... Surely the official Barack Obama website could have produced even louder calls for hope and change if it had claimed 52 million Americans have no health insurance. And there are those among that 52 million who do need help with their medical bills. People who make a decent wage, but have chronic or degenerative conditions, who need expensive prescription drugs, who have sick children. And there's me. Only 2 years remain before I can drink, medicinally, from the Medicare tap. But what if, in the meantime, an unknown admirer were to send me a box of genuine Havana Monte Cristo number 3s, putting me off my Nicorettes, and my health insurance company finds out. There's something unhealthy, anyway, about framing a medical debate in terms of insurance. If your house catches fire, do you call Allstate or the fire department? We'll figure out how to pay for the health care if we live. If we don't, fuck it. The purpose of insurance is not to cure all that ails us, but simply to prevent the plot of The Merchant of Venice. Antonio's covered by AIG and isn't worried about being short on cash to lend to Bassanio for wooing Portia. Tony can do a derivative swap and rake in the ducats. Shylock stays home watching interest rate fluctuations on the Bloomberg Business Canal. His daughter Jessica never gets a chance to go mashugana over Lorenzo, a schmuck, I'm telling you, and run off and charge a fortune on Dad's Venetian Express card. And nobody's forced to become a mackerel snapper in Act 5. True, Shylock never delivers his "If you prick us, do we not bleed?" soliloquy, which put an end to anti-Semitism in Europe for the next 400 years, but everything comes with a price. Making everyone get health insurance has been tried in the United States, in Massachusetts, under the aegis of Republican Governor Mitt Romney. As of July 1, 2007, everybody in the state had to either enroll in a state or federal program, if eligible, or buy a private insurance policy with no limit on annual benefits and a yearly maximum deductible of $5,000 per individual and $10,000 per family. Massachusetts provides subsidies for private insurance policies purchased by families with incomes up to 300% of the poverty level. All employers with 10 or more employees must provide health insurance for their workers or be assessed $295 per year per worker, and an individual who fails to get health insurance is charged $912 a year by the state. Carrots are available in a stir-fry of small sticks. Michael Tanner, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, wrote a report on what could be called the clinical test trial of universal insurance with Massachusetts as the clinic. Tanner concluded that it's all worked pretty much as expected, if you expect government programs to work the way I expect them to. The insurance subsidies were intended to cost state taxpayers $725 million a year. They cost more, as things that cost taxpayers usually do. By mid-2008, Massachusetts was estimating that the health insurance subsidies would cost $869 million in 2009 and $880 million in 2010. Income from assessments and penalties was supposed to be $45 million in 2007 and $36 million in 2008. There was no income from assessments and penalties in 2007 and $7 million in 2008. At the time of Tanner's report, the price of Massachusetts health care reform in 2009 was projected to be $225 million more than had been anticipated. State spending on all health care programs had risen by 42% since 2006, and health care reform was calculated to account for about a third of the $1.3 billion 2008 state deficit. The percentage of people without health insurance in Massachusetts did decline by 74% from 2006 to 2009, but somehow 167,000 state residents were still left without health insurance. And this is a state with only 6.5 million people, where those 6.5 million have a greater per capita disposable income than the people of any other state except Connecticut, New Jersey, and Wyoming. Footnote: New Jersey? That's what the U.S. Commerce Department's Statistical Abstract of the United States says. But New Jerseyites spent it all on hairstyling products. And what's with Wyoming? Did China buy it? End note. Meanwhile, guess what Michael Tanner said about health insurance premiums in Massachusetts? Or, if you prefer to get your information from a source less biased toward free enterprise than the Cato Institute, here is a headline and subhead from the August 22, 2009 Boston Globe. Bay State premiums highest in country. Rein in health care costs, Massachusetts urged. I couldn't have gotten into a medical school. I couldn't have gotten into a veterinary school for goldfish. Blush twice and call me in the morning. At the college where I went, all they taught about health care was how to nurse a hangover. But I do know something about going to hospitals, and about other people who go to hospitals, and about the percentage of us people who go to hospitals needing medical treatment who get it, which, in America, would be 100. If you're sick or injured and you come to an emergency room, they have to take you in. It's the law. That this doesn't cost health care providers a fortune is not a law. Much of what happens in the American healthcare industry would, in any other business, be called shoplifting. Even in utopian Massachusetts, where the number of people without health insurance dropped by 74%, the number of people who received unreimbursed care from the state's hospitals dropped by only 36%. I also know something about politics. The Affordable Health Care for Americans Act, passed by the House of Representatives on November 7, 2009, was 1,990 pages long. You could stand on it to paint the ceiling. The entire U.S. Constitution can be printed on 8 pages. That's 8 pages to run a whole country for 221 years versus 4 reams of government pig Latin if you slam your thumb in a car door. No congressman had read this bill, even assuming they all can read, and the busy president of the United States could hardly have had time to do so. Not that this matters. Healthcare reform is the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue of politics. Beautiful, enticing, generously endowed legislation like this is not for reading. How it looks is what matters. From the neck up, it can be as empty as you like. There's only one thing about a government proposal of this complexity that we can be sure of. It won't work. No government proposal more complex than "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private," ever works, and that one hasn't been working lately. Also, doesn't anybody in Congress remember that Hillary Clinton has already been there with health care reform 17 years ago? A lot of people say that Hillary's health care reform plan almost destroyed Bill Clinton's first term. It certainly diminished Hillary's influence in the White House. Bill had to seek help from a different woman to almost destroy his second term. There's a simpler way to make health care cheaper. Just make it worse. And politics can do that. Government-controlled health care will drive the best people out of the business. Who wants to spend all those years studying to be a doctor just to end up as a petty bureaucrat? Someday we'll be wheeled in for a heart bypass operation and the surgeon will be the same person who's now behind the counter when we renew our registration at the Department of Motor Vehicles. If we're not careful, we'll get a healthcare system like they've got in Canada, a nation that's going broke from healthcare spending, even though Canada is a sparsely populated country with a shortage of gunshot wounds, crack addicts, and huge tort judgments. Anyway, what are Americans supposed to learn from a healthcare system devoted to removing pucks from goalie bridge work and treating sinus infections caused by trying to pronounce French vowels? What we'll learn is to fix prices, because that's all the political healthcare reform is, price fixing. Price fixing works so well in Cuba and North Korea, and in New York City rent-controlled apartments. Everybody knows how easy it is to find an inexpensive apartment in a nice neighborhood in New York. And by the way, why is price fixing a public service when the government does it and a great big crime when Wall Street CEOs get together on a golf course? Personally, I do smoke. Footnote, Monte Cristo number threes. There's a place in Toronto where you can buy them, and they'll take the H.O. in Cuba cigar bands off and mail them to me in a box marked Made in Honduras. And they're telling U.S. Customs the truth, the box is made in Honduras. End note. And drink, and my idea of exercise is getting up at 3 a.m. to go to the bathroom. I'm self-employed, and I have to buy my own health insurance. I hardly need to say that it comes with a high deductible and doesn't exactly cover everything. In fact, when my wife became pregnant 13 years ago, I discovered that my health insurance did not cover normal pregnancy. In fairness, a pregnancy isn't an illness or an injury, and there's no such thing as it being an accident if you're Catholic. We went to the hospital. My wife endured labor pains and the even bigger pain of having me there, uselessly hysterical. She gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, Muffin. Mother and daughter were going fine. They were ready to be discharged. I went to the hospital's business administration office and said, "How much do I owe you?" The woman at the desk stared at me dumbfounded. She said, "Please complete all requisite insurance forms." I said, "There's no insurance involved. Do you take credit cards or would you like a check?" She stared at me dumbfounded. I said, "Or if you wait a moment, I can go to the bank and get cash." Finally, she said, "I have to get my supervisor." The supervisor came out and stared at me dumbfounded. The supervisor had no idea how to handle this situation. From all appearances, no one had ever before attempted to actually personally pay anybody for health care. 5. Climate change. There's not a goddamn thing you can do about it. Maybe climate change is a threat, and maybe climate change has been tarted up by climatologists trolling for research grant cash. Doesn't matter. There are 1.3 billion people in China, and they all want a Buick. Actually, if you go more than a mile or two outside China's big cities, the wants are more basic. People want a hot plate and a piece of methane-emitting cow to cook on it. They want a carbon-belching moped and some CO2-disgorging heat in their houses in the winter. And air conditioning wouldn't be considered an imposition if you've ever been to China in the summer. Now I want you to dress yourself in sturdy clothing and arm yourself however you like. A stiff shot of gin would be my recommendation. And I want you to go tell 1.3 billion Chinese they can never have a Buick. Then, assuming the Sierra Club helicopter has rescued you in time, I want you to go tell a billion people in India the same thing. 6. The end of the American automobile industry. To understand what doomed the American automobile, we should give up on economics and turn to melodrama. Politicians, journalists, financial analysts, and other purveyors of banality have been looking at cars as if a convertible were a business. Fire the MBAs and hire a poet. The fate of Detroit isn't a matter of financial crisis, foreign competition, corporate greed, union intransigence, energy costs, or carbon emissions. It's a tragic romance. Unleashed passions, titanic clashes, lost love, and wild horses. Foremost are the horses. Cars can't be comprehended without horse sense. 100-and-some years ago, Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem, The Ballad of the King's Jest, in which an Afghan tribesman avers, Four things greater than all things are women and horses and power and war. Insert another power after the horse, and the verse was as true in the suburbs of my boyhood as it was in the Khyber Pass. Horsepower is